Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, October 31st, 2025, we are delighted to host this litigation update on Lang v. Houston County, Georgia. My name is Matthew Sautel, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. In the interest of time, we'll keep the introductions brief, but if you'd like to know more about any of our panelists, you can access their full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have Christopher Mills as our speaker and Rachel Morrison as our moderator. Mrs. Morrison is a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, where she directs the center's Administrative State Accountability Project. One last note throughout the panel, if you have any questions, please submit them through the question and answer feature in Zoom so that we'll have access to them when we get to that portion of the webinar. We do ask that questions submitted there both pertain to the discussion and end with a question mark. With that, thank you for being with us today. Mrs. Morrison, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Matthew. It's great to be here, and I'm delighted that we have Christopher Mills to discuss this case with us. Christopher, for those who don't know, is a phenomenal attorney. He's the founder of Sparrow Law. He's the Supreme Court clerk, Harvard Law School grad, and particularly relevant for our discussion today, he filed an amicus brief in the Lang case. Chris, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Rachel. Looking forward to it.
How about you start off with the background and the facts of the case?
Yeah, so this case, the plaintiff is Anna Lang, who is a biological male, a deputy at the Houston County Sheriff's Office. Lang sought coverage for a male-to-female sex change surgery after being diagnosed with gender dysphoria. The county's insurance policy denied that request based on an exclusion for drugs for sex change surgery and services and supplies for a sex change and or reversal of a sex change. The district court held that this exclusion facially discriminated because of sex as a matter of law, so granted summary judgment for Lang on Lang's Title VII claim. And so that's sort of the background. There was also a separate claim in the case involving intentional discrimination in violation of the Equal Protection Clause. Lang claimed that the exclusion was had a disproportionate impact and a discriminatory intent. That claim the district court had denied summary judgment on because of factual disputes about discriminatory intent. And so that claim was not before the 11th Circuit. Only the Title VII claim was before the 11th Circuit. In other words, the central issue before the 11th Circuit was whether the health insurance policy, by denying coverage for sex change surgeries or their reversal, facially violates Title VII.
And can you give folks a background on Title VII for those who are not familiar?
Sure. So broadly speaking, Title VII prohibits discrimination in employment along a number of classifications, including race and sex. It was most prominently at issue in the Supreme Court a few terms ago in the court's Bostock decision, where the court ruled that discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity is discrimination on the basis of sex for purposes of Title VII. The court's logic there was that if you change a person's sex in either of those situations, sexual orientation or gender identity, and they are treated differently simply because you change the sex, then there is sex discrimination, and the court said that existed for both sexual orientation or gender identity. So, for example, if a man was terminated for being in a relationship with another man because a woman wouldn't have been terminated for being in a relationship with a man, there was sex discrimination. So that was basically Bostock, which will play a big role in later cases, including Lang.
And so this is a decision out of the en banc 11th Circuit. What happened at the 11th Circuit panel?
So the panel ruled for Lang and basically said that the district court got it right, that the policy discriminated based on sex by denying coverage for sex change operations.
And then the en banc 11th Circuit agreed to hear this case, and how did they rule?
So the en banc court went the other way. First, it's important to note that in the intervening period, the Supreme Court decided Scarametti, United States versus Scarametti, which was everyone on the call probably is aware of it, but just to summarize briefly, was a case before the U.S. Supreme Court in which the court considered Tennessee's general prohibition of medical transitioning interventions on minors. And the court there was confronted with an equal protection claim. The claim was that that regulation discriminated based on sex. The court held that it did not. Basically, the logic of the court's opinion, for the majority anyway, was that giving puberty blockers to a male for purposes of gender transition is different treatment than giving puberty blockers to either a male or a female for other purposes. And so the fact that doctors would be allowed to give puberty blockers or the drugs used as cross-sex hormones for other medical treatments didn't mean that the state had discriminated based on sex by regulating their use in medical transitioning. And because there was no discrimination based on sex, the court applied rational basis review, pointed to developments in Europe, pointed to the CAS review in the United Kingdom, pointed to substantial uncertainty about how medical transitioning outcomes are for children, and said that Tennessee had a rational basis for adopting the law. Of course, if the dissenters there had prevailed, and if the court had said that the regulation did discriminate based on sex, then intermediate scrutiny would apply. That was Scarametti. This is a Title VII case, of course, Lang, and that means the analysis is a little bit different because the law basically prohibits discrimination based on sex. So rather than having some sort of, well, if it does, then, you know, the defendant can still prevail if they can satisfy intermediate scrutiny, it's just prohibited. So there's not that sort of second step. The only question is, did the policy facially discriminate based on sex? And so the en banc 11th Circuit said, no, it didn't. And first, it explained that the intent of the policy didn't matter because the Title VII claim was for facial discrimination. Again, that's different than the equal protection claim, which focused on whether there was a discriminatory intent behind the policy. And that claim still, as far as I know, at the district court. The en banc court basically addressed and rejected four arguments by Lang asserting that the policy did facially discriminate based on sex. First, Lang argued that under Bostock's but-for causation test, the plan discriminated based on sex because coverage would have been provided if Lang were born female, but was denied because Lang was born male. The majority disagreed, citing Scarametti, which established that the law did not classify based on sex because it did not prohibit conduct for one sex that it permits for the other. So the court applied that logic here and said the county's policy does not pay for a sex change operation for anyone, no matter what their biological sex is. If Lang were a biological woman seeking a female to male sex change, the policy would also deny coverage. The policy exclusion doesn't hinge, therefore, on whether the employee is a man or a woman. The court also explained that the specific procedures involved in Lang surgery, the male to female sex change, which would be removal of testicles and creation of a neo-vagina, would be denied to both biological men and women as part of a sex change, but would be covered for medical conditions like cancer or some sort of traumatic injury. So again, as in Scrimeti, the court emphasized that there's the difference lies in treatment, not sex, and therefore sex is simply not a but-for cause of the denial. The next sort of broad claim of discrimination that Lange presented was discrimination based on transgender status. The argument was that the plan discriminates based on transgender status because it limits coverage for treatment for gender dysphoria, which is a diagnosis that some transgender people have. It's basically distress associated with a feeling of an opposite gender. The majority, however, and the 11th Circuit concluded that the plan did not facially discriminate based on transgender status. First, the court explained that the Supreme Court has not held that transgender status is separately protected under Title VII apart from sex. So while Bostock, you know, suggested that sometimes there was a connection between gender identity and sex, it did not hold that transgender status is a separate protected classification under Title VII. And then, again, drawing on Bostock, the court said that the policy is a classification based on medical use, not transgender status. It removes one set of diagnoses, gender dysphoria, gender identity disorder, gender incongruence, from the range of treatable conditions, but it doesn't exclude individuals based on their status. So there could be transgender people who do not have those diagnoses who could desire these treatments or not desire these treatments. And the point is, it doesn't matter. The plan would, the court said that the plan would also cover medical procedures involved in a sex change, such as, again, surgery following some sort of traumatic injury, whether or not the employee was transgender. So again, the court emphasized what the purpose or the treatment was. The next theory of discrimination that Lange presented was that the plan facially discriminates based on sex stereotypes. The majority said that it did not. Otherwise, it would cover procedures that align a person's physical characteristics with their biological sex. So here you could think of a detransitioner seeking some of these similar sex change operations to go to realign with their biological sex. But the plan, the court emphasized, doesn't cover those either. Instead, it excludes coverage for procedures that change the appearance of sex organs, regardless of whether the goal is to align with or differ from biological sex or any sex stereotype. And then the last claim that Lange presented was that the exclusion penalizes a person for transitioning. The court rejected this theory too. It said that the plan does not impose a surcharge on employees who have undergone a sex change. Rather, it simply declines to extend a benefit coverage for a sex change operation to everyone. And this echoed a point that Judge Brasher, who wrote the en banc majority opinion and had dissented at the panel stage, made, which was that in some respects, this was simply a cheap insurance plan. So in other words, you can't take a plan's exclusions for sex change reversals and a bunch of other things and zero in on the exclusion for sex change and say, oh, it's discriminating based on sex, when in reality the plan just simply doesn't cover a lot of surgeries or other expensive operations. So basically, to summarize all that, and I apologize, that was a long summary. The majority held that the county's plan merely draws a line between covered and non-covered treatments. It's a classification based on medical use that applies across the board, regardless of sex, and therefore it's not facial discrimination based on a protected status under Title VII.
So the county's plan covered some treatments for gender dysphoria. Did this fact play a role at all in the court's analysis? Would it have been different if there was a blanket exclusion for all treatments for gender dysphoria, or did this not come up at all in the court's analysis?
So the court mentioned that there were some counseling and other, I think to some extent the plan covered some medications to some extent that could be used as a transitioning in the process of transitioning, but not drugs for sex change surgeries. So the court did highlight that, you know, sort of counseling, for example, could be provided. And Lange, in fact, had, if I'm remembering correctly, taken advantage of some of the services that the plan did cover. So that was of at least some relevance to the court's decision, I think.
And these four theories of discrimination that Lange raised that you talked about, these were all arguments that it facially discriminated. Are there other types of violations of Title VII that could come into play, such as like a different claim, not a facial discrimination claim, or were these not raised in the case below?
Yeah, other theories had not really been raised in the case below.
It seems like this case, though, would foreclose a facial discrimination claim, but maybe another plaintiff in another case could raise a case involving animus or some other type of claim outside of a facial discrimination claim. Is that your reading?
Yeah, that's right. And again, even in this case, Lange's equal protection discriminatory intent claim, was separate from this one.
So there was a couple concurrences and a couple dissents. Did any of these stand out to you as being particularly notable or raising certain arguments that would be interesting for folks listening?
Yeah, I think there was a lot happening of interest in the separate opinions here. So Judge Newsom concurred in full with the majority opinion. His point was that Lange's Title VII challenge is foreclosed by the portion of Scrimeti that addresses and explains how Bostock would apply to equal protection. But he wrote separately to emphasize that the legal analyses governing claims under Title VII and equal protection should not collapse. So this is a big point of ongoing controversy in the circuit courts. The Supreme Court has not addressed it. It avoided the issue in Scrimeti, which is how Bostock, which was decided in Title VII context, applies to other legal context that in some way prohibits sex discrimination, including the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment and other federal laws like Title IX. We can maybe talk about this later, but this term, the Supreme Court has several Title IX sports cases involving these types of issues. And one of the big questions there is, does Bostock apply? That was also a big question in Scrimeti, but the court there kind of avoided it by saying, well, even if Bostock does apply to equal protection, which we're not deciding, it wouldn't help the challengers to Tennessee's law because it's just regulating based on the treatment or the purpose. So Judge Newsom weighs in here and says, basically explaining why, in his view, he doesn't think that Title VII and equal protection should kind of both be governed by Bostock necessarily. He emphasizes that they use different words, that they were adopted nearly a century apart. He emphasizes the Equal Protection Clause covers all types of discriminatory actions, whereas Title VII only reaches employment-related discrimination, but applies to both private and public entities, unlike the Equal Protection Clause, which only applies to public entities. He emphasizes the equal protection, and we talked about this earlier, prohibits only intentional discrimination, while Title VII covers any discrimination. And he, in his view, he says the Equal Protection Clause focuses on classifications and groups, so men, women, whereas Title VII's focus must be on individuals. That particular point is a topic of hot dispute, and you can kind of find Supreme Court cases going both ways on that, which is why judges in the lower courts have disagreed. I think Judge Richardson on the Fourth Circuit took the opposite view from Judge Newsom here, if I'm remembering correctly. And so this is very much an ongoing disagreement in the courts. In terms of other en banc separate writings in Lange, Judge Rosenbaum concurred in the judgment, stating that she thought she was bound by Scarametti. She said she could find no meaningful way to distinguish the health care plan in Lange from the Tennessee law in Scarametti. But in her view, she said Scarametti wrongly applied Bostock's test, wrongly determined that the Tennessee law did not discriminate based on sex or transgender status. She was particularly aggravated that Scarametti seemed to import the reasoning of Godaldig, a case from a number of decades ago where the court said that discrimination based on alleged discrimination based on pregnancy was not necessarily discrimination based on sex, the reasoning being that some women are pregnant and some women are not pregnant. And so the sort of a mismatch of categories there. Judge Rosenbaum said that Congress had amended Title VII to reject that specific holding and extend Title VII to discrimination based on pregnancy, which she took as a rejection of Godaldig's entire theoretical framework. We can talk about that more later. But still, she concurred in the judgment because she thought she was bound by Scarametti. The dissents obviously disagreed. They said that Scarametti did not bind them because Scarametti didn't actually decide whether Bostock's reasoning applied beyond the Title VII context. So in other words, their claim was that Scarametti didn't really apply Bostock because it didn't ever say that Bostock applied to equal protection. And so they sort of then agreed with Judge Rosenbaum that under Title VII, Congress had rejected Godaldig and that approach to deciding whether there was discrimination based on sex. And so therefore would have found that there was discrimination based on sex.
So one of the dissents cited an amicus brief, which is the one you filed. Would you like to share a little bit about your brief and how the judge decided to bring in your amicus brief into the discussion, even though it wasn't cited in the majority opinion?
Sure. So I filed the brief in the case on behalf of the Christian Employers Alliance, which had sort of a legal argument and then an explanation of why the panel's decision would be problematic for employers, especially religious employers who have a sincere objection to paying for transitioning interventions. So my brief basically echoed Scarametti, though it was filed before that, which explained, you know, sex doesn't matter, whether you're a man or a woman, you don't get coverage for a sex change operation or its reversal. For the same reason, it's not discrimination based on gender identity or gender stereotypes. The brief also explains that the panel's opinion would seem to suggest that it's actually the physicians who would be providing the sex change surgeries who would be discriminating based on sex. So under the theory that whether a person can obtain a sex change operation is entails sex discrimination, it's actually the private providers who are discriminating based on sex. They are the ones who choose gender transition procedures based on the person's biological sex. So the brief explains doctors wouldn't perform Lange's penile inversion on a female. They would not give a male testosterone to transition or a female estrogen. And they make these decisions based on gender identity, refusing procedures to those whose gender identity aligns with their sex. And they diagnose gender dysphoria in the first place based on diagnoses founded in stereotypes like whether a person prefers typically masculine or typically feminine activities. So, the brief explained that on the panel's theory, then, you know, it's those private decisions that are actually constituting facial sex discrimination because a person's sex is, quote, inextricably tied to what gender dysphoria FOIA interventions they are offered. And then by that logic, the county's the county's plan is prohibiting sex discrimination. It is not itself sex discrimination. So in other words, it's a way of explaining that if you adopt the theory, the whole thing kind of collapses on itself.
The theory of a Bostock.
We were specifically focusing on the theory of Lange, but the Lange panel decision. But yeah, if you applied Bostock with and ignored the differences in treatments and procedures, then that's where you end up. It sort of collapses on itself. And then I explained, it actually is a step worse even, because if the panel were right that the county's exclusion was sex discrimination, then it would also be sex discrimination to cover transitioning hormones, say testosterone for females to look more masculine, and refusing to cover testosterone for males who want to look more masculine themselves. So you see the same problem in the sports cases. If it's sex discrimination to prohibit a male to play in female sports, and then it would also be sex discrimination to prohibit other males to play in female sports, even if they don't identify as female. And so what that shows basically is that the panel's logic, and to some extent Bostock's logic, would mean that any procedure related to gender transition gets special and universal coverage regardless of why or how the procedure is used. Because you could always say, oh, well, if they were the other sex, there would be some other intervention that would be covered. And so therefore you have to cover the sex change operation. And in fact, you could take it a step further, as the brief discusses and as the amicus brief for Alabama shows, which is that the same logic would apply to all treatments tied to sex. So any treatment, giving someone testicular exam, if it didn't cover that for women, then it would discriminate based on sex. In other words, the panel's logic would mean that any treatment tied to sex would have to be universally covered, or else it would be facially sex discrimination. And the brief makes the point that this is nonsensical, that sex change operations are sex-based doesn't make every regulation pertaining to them discriminatory. And then it says, we say, quote, giving a female testosterone to transition is not the same procedure as giving testosterone to a male to treat hypogonadism or to win the Tour de France. A mastectomy for cancer treatment is not the same as removing healthy breasts for sex change. And so, and then the brief went on to explain why the consequences of the panel decision would be so bad for employers, especially religious employers with a sincere religious objection to covering sex change reversals. So all that gets me back to your question, which was how this brief came up in the dissenting opinion. And one of the dissenting opinions was, I guess, upset by the brief, in particular that explanation that those treatments wouldn't be the same. Giving a mastectomy to treat cancer is not the same as a mastectomy for gender transition purposes, even though that was one of the exact same examples that Judge Rosenbaum used. The dissenting opinion said that this revealed the opposition of groups opposed to transgender equality, revealed their true perspective. And then the dissenting quotes a piece of the argument I just said, and said the disdain is palpable, and then sort of accused the majority opinion of providing fodder for bad evil groups like the Christian Employers Alliance. And then in fact returns to the Christian Employers Alliance and two more footnotes suggesting that the organization is questioning the quote very existence of transgender people. The dissenting opinion warned that the group doesn't hide its goal to stop gender transition mandates. And sort of implied that this was some sort of nefarious purpose. Of course, the Christian Employers Alliance, like many Americans, has a religious belief that people were created male and female. In fact, that belief is shared by many non-religious people who understand that that's the situation in the animal kingdom largely, and was the viewpoint given by Justice Ginsburg in the VMI case, that where she said, quote, physical differences between men and women are, quote, inherent, enduring, and cause for celebration. But I think this was remarkable to find this sort of rhetoric that by opposing universal coverage of sex change operations as a mandatory matter of federal law somehow showed that a group was somehow questioning the existence of transgender people, or sort of attacking them directly. I think that's an argument you would find more often in the media than in a judicial opinion, especially when the argument was presented by an amicus. So all that to say, I found that portion of the dissenting opinion surprising, and but it sort of underscores how intensely emotional these cases can be to some people.
Yeah, I think there's a couple points maybe worth emphasizing, that we're talking about what is the scope of health insurance benefits, not do these individuals have access to the benefits. And then it seems like under the dissent's theory of discrimination, if you offer any health insurance benefits, you would have to offer the entire spectrum of anything that's sex specific in order to not violate this theory of discrimination that they're upholding. I mean, this is something that I've written about that's going to be published in the Catholic Law Review this coming year, about how this theory of discrimination can't just be cabined to like this specific subset of treatments. It would have to apply to any protected basis under the law where discrimination is prohibited, which would, as I say in the Law Review article, opens Pandora's box, which is why I title it "Avoiding Pandora's Box." But I think that this is an interesting dynamic of what is the scope of benefits that should be provided, which is a different question than does this group of people have access to the benefits. I think that these issues have been coming up under the 14th Amendment. They've been coming up under Title VII. They've also been coming up under Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act, which is the non-discrimination provision of the Affordable Care Act that prohibits sex discrimination in federally funded healthcare programs and activities. It also comes up in disability discrimination cases, alleging that gender dysphoria is a protected disability, and then excluding these treatments for gender dysphoria would be disability discrimination. How do you think that this case will impact the discussion moving forward in other courts? Obviously, this is just one circuit court opinion and not a Supreme Court opinion that's binding across the board.
Right. Yeah. So obviously this decision governs in the 11th Circuit, and there are somewhat contrary decisions in some other circuits to be aware of. The 4th Circuit has a couple cases that go the other way. Some of those cases are kind of being reconsidered now in light of Scrimeti. So, but I think otherwise it's very much of an open question. You know, a big open question, which Scrimeti didn't resolve, but a number of the separate opinions did, was whether discrimination based on whether transgender status is a quasi-suspect class for purposes of the Equal Protection Clause. Justice Barrett and Justice Alito weighed in on that. I think a big question is how Bostock applies to equal protection, to Title IX. Again, Judge Newsom's opinion here tries to get at that. I think there's a lot of questions about how to do Bostock, because if you read the separate opinions in the 11th Circuit, they felt quite strongly that Bostock's application was very simple here. And in Bostock, Justice Gorsuch made it seem like it was easy. Whereas in Scrimeti seems to say, well, actually, it's a little bit more complicated than this. Just change one thing and that's it. And don't look at anything else. And so I think there's questions about that. I would flag Judge Rosenbaum has a very, very long footnote about how to try and do Bostock in the context of sex change procedures and whether the comparator is, if we're trying to imagine a male like Lang seeking of a removal of testicles, how to compare that to a female, how do we even begin to do what Bostock says and just change the sex and see what happens. And she has it's footnote 16 in her opinion, a very long involved discussion of how to do that. So I think there's a lot of questions still about how to deal with, how to actually apply Bostock, in real world situations. But to go back to your question, I think that while this kind of addresses this issue for the 11th Circuit, and I would imagine that most other circuits would find the analysis pretty persuasive in light of Scrimeti. Again, that's why you had Judge Rosenbaum here saying, I think Scrimeti was totally wrong, but it is what it is, and so I have to follow it. So I think it will likely be persuasive to other courts confronting these types of issues. But as you said, there are other legal provisions that can come up in some of these cases. Lang had an ADA claim that got dropped. There's Section 1557 claims. The argument I was mentioning earlier about, if you think this is sex discrimination, then it seems like the private providers are actually the ones discriminating based on sex. There's 1557 applies to those people. And so there's kind of a question of how that would operate. And then you just have all the other categories of gender related cases, not just sports, but you have birth certificate, you have prisons, you have driver's licenses, you have a number of employee issues other than health insurance coverage. So I think there's a lot of unanswered questions here.
And maybe the question is we'll have to wait and find out, but do you see this case having an impact on those other cases or the reasoning applying, or is the reasoning in this case pretty narrowly focused on the insurance issue?
I think the case is pretty significant and important because it's really the first big case trying to figure out what Scrimeti means in these other areas, including Title VII. And so the extension of Scrimeti, even though it didn't decide whether to apply Bostock, the fact that the court said, well, here's how we would apply it if it applied, the fact that judges are saying that tells them how to do Bostock, even in the Title VII case, is pretty significant, I think. And again, just having an en banc circuit court decide one of these follow-up cases is pretty significant. So I do think this opinion is worth looking at. I think it'll get a lot of attention in upcoming cases. But as you said, it is somewhat limited by the fact that it is just about Title VII, and it is just about a health insurance coverage. And there's obviously many other legal doctrines and many other gender-related issues out there.
I think it might be interesting for folks if we take a step back to the Gudeldig case. I think an underlying theme in a lot of these cases that folks might not be aware of this case and kind of how this plays in. But that case involved disability benefits. And so, again, it was a benefits type case. And just how that case and then the Congress's passing of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, which the Supreme Court has said disapproved of both the holding and the reasoning of the prior Gudeldig case for Title VII, how that then applies and impacts issues outside of pregnancy.
Sure. So Gudeldig was a 1974 case, and the critical point of the logic there was that the disability policy divided employees basically into two groups, those who were pregnant and those who weren't. And at least the group who weren't pregnant could include women. There is a lack of identity between the policy and sex. So in other words, both groups could include, at least one of the groups, you know, the group of pregnant people would be all women. The group of which is its own controversial issue, but the group of non-pregnant women would be could be male and female. And so, in other words, you had females on both sides of the line. So there wasn't facial sex discrimination. You know, in this context, the 11th Circuit in a case called Adams involving school bathrooms had made a similar point. You know, the bathroom policy divided students into two groups, and there was, you know, some transgender people would want to use either bathroom, and so there was a lack of identity between the policy and transgender status. And the 11th Circuit's opinion in Lange didn't rely a lot on Godaldig but that was mainly because Scrimeti had sort of relied on Godaldig. Again, that was what the concurrence and the judgment and the dissenting opinions in Lange were upset about. Here, I actually think in the gender context, it's easier than Godaldig because if you transfer that theory here, you have an insurance policy that divides employees into two groups, those who want sex change operation and those who do not. The group that does not seek sex change operation could include transgender employees who just don't want those operations. And so under Godaldig, there's a lack of identity between the policy and transgender status. Here, it goes another step though, because the group that does want sex change operations could include non-transgender employees, for instance, people who are detransitioning. So you actually have even less of an identity between sex and or the protected characteristic in the policy than you did in Godaldig, where at least the pregnant category was all women. So anyway, the question, though, is what happened after that? Congress amended Title VII to basically overrule Godaldig as to pregnancy, adding that Title VII covered discrimination, quote, on the basis of pregnancy, childbirth, or related medical conditions. And then the Supreme Court later applied that and said it made it unlawful to treat pregnancy-related conditions less favorably than other medical conditions, even though the group of non-pregnant employees includes some women.
EDA added an additional phrase as well, which I think is also significant, saying that you have to treat like pregnancy the same for fringe benefits as other conditions as well. So I think that additional phrase also plays into this idea that it's specific to pregnancy.
Right. Yeah, that's right. So but the argument, the Biden administration made this argument in Lange, was that pregnancy amended entirely abrogated Godaldig's logic. So in other words, the claim was that Congress rejected this whole, well, there's two categories and one of them includes both sides of the line. And so there's a lack of identity. Their claim was that by adding the pregnancy amendments, Congress said, no, that's the wrong way to interpret Title VII. I think that's, and my brief makes this argument, and I know your article does as well, that's an overreading of the statute. The statutory amendment simply added pregnancy. And so it obviously abrogated Godaldig's specific holding that pregnancy discrimination isn't sex discrimination, but it didn't say that this is the wrong way to think about Title VII. And so I think that's a big question. And again, that's something that the separate opinions make a big deal about.
And it seems like after Bostock and Bostock's direction, you have to look directly at the words of the statute itself, would seem to suggest that whatever Congress's intent or people maybe thought it was going to be, you have to look at exactly what Congress did in the statute itself. And they didn't disavow the theory of discrimination across the board. They address the pregnancy specific issue.
Right. And that's what Bostock said over and over again, you know, quote, only the words on the page constitute the law adopted by Congress and approved by the president. And so I think if you take Bostock seriously, if you take textualism seriously, then you can't say, oh, well, they added pregnancy. So therefore, the whole mode of analysis was rejected.
Well, I'd like to take a minute and ask folks who are listening, if you have any questions, please drop it in the Q&A. We are excited to talk about this case and the interactions. I think a lot of these, this case and the discussion, there's a lot of unanswered questions of what's coming next, the interaction between Title VII and the 14th Amendment, Bostock and Scrimeti, and there's been this interplay between the Supreme Courts and various circuit courts, and then obviously all the applications, whether it's insurance coverage or sports and the like. And so it'll be really interesting, I think, to see how this case will play a role, whether it'll come up in the Supreme Court's sports cases, oral arguments, or in other cases that are considering either the insurance exclusion under Title VII or other issues, or other cases involving gender identity or gender dysphoria or transgender status. I don't see any questions at the moment. Chris, are there other points you think would be helpful for folks, or anything else you would like to say?
Let's see. I think I've covered it. Do you have any? You've thought about this a lot. So, do you have any thoughts while we're waiting for any questions?
I think it'll just be interesting to see how much this case gets cited in all of these other cases that are percolating in the courts. This case seemed to read Scrimeti's analysis of Bostock in that context. Like, if we were applying Bostock, how would it come out as then being controlling in the Title VII context? Which is interesting because Scrimeti wasn't a Title VII case, but then if their analysis of Bostock and then comes back into Title VII. So I think that'll be interesting to see if all the circuit court judges and these other circuits start, if that's how they read Bostock, or if they're going to go with the dissents and say that it was a 14th Amendment case, we don't have to apply it, it's different. Justice Gorsuch and his concurrence in Students for Fair Admission talks about how these are very different statutes and we don't need to get into it at all. Or we don't automatically apply 14th Amendment and Title VII together. We do have one question. Is this case likely to be subject to a cert petition? Great question.
Yeah, I doubt it. I mean, I don't, I think there's been some hesitancy on the part of challengers like Lange to continue to push these challenges, especially after Scrimeti. You saw many of the medical related challenges dropped, even though many of those cases also raise a separate substantive due process claim about the right of parents to supposedly medically transition their child. That claim was not dealt with in Scrimeti, and practically all of the challenges to state laws still had that claim, and practically all of them have been dismissed by the plaintiffs, presumably because they saw the writing on the wall. So it's hard to think and then I would add, you see it to some extent even at the Supreme Court. You know, the sports cases that plaintiffs sort of pushed up to the Supreme Court, now one of two of them they're trying to get out of it. The plaintiff there has suddenly disclaimed an interest in playing college sports, and so is trying to voluntarily dismiss the case and argue to the Supreme Court that it's moot. So in other words, I think after Scrimeti, they don't want the Supreme Court saying anything else about this to the extent they can avoid it. So I would be surprised if a cert petition were filed here, but that doesn't mean the Supreme Court isn't going to see this issue. I mean, it's all it's going to take is one circuit, the Fourth Circuit, the First Circuit, the Ninth Circuit, going the other way. And then there will be a circuit split and there will be a cert petition. So, you know, whether it's coming eventually, I would say there's a decent chance at it. But I would personally, I'd be surprised if they took this one up.
There was a couple pending cert petitions last term involving insurance exclusions for the sex rejecting procedures, and those got kicked back down, and those involved 14th Amendment. And then one of them, I don't remember if it was 1557 or Title VII, but it seems like the Scrimeti probably has foreclosed a lot of these 14th Amendment claims, but I think we're going to start seeing a lot more of the federal statutory discrimination claims under Title VII, Section 1557, under the Rehabilitation Act and Americans with Disabilities Act. And then I also think that we might start seeing state law claims, whether that's state constitutional claims, like equal protection type claims, or state non-discrimination law claims as well. And it kind of reminds me of some of what's maybe happened in the abortion context, where if it's, it kind of shifts from federal arguments to more to the states, and then you have more of a patchwork, or if one avenue is foreclosed, then it, the trying to argue or reach into some of the others. But I think it'll just be really interesting. There's going to be a continued conversation, and okay, maybe not 14th Amendment, but now what about Title VII? What about, you know, disability discrimination on the federal level? Okay, if that's foreclosed, then there's going to be all these state claims. And then how does that interact with the federal law? Maybe it's not required under federal law, but if it's not prohibited, then it seems like it might then be required in the state as well. Okay, I don't see any other questions. Any final words, Chris?
Nope, I think that's it.
Awesome, thank you. I was going to say, I think Matthew's going to hop back on now.
Yeah, thank you both. So on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank you, especially your experts, right, for the benefit of your time and expertise today. And I want to thank you, our audience, for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about upcoming virtual events, the biggest one being the NLC next week. So thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.